I could just tell you a story about this. So at this stage I'm going to delegate. I'm going to ask Marcus if you would please read Corinthians chapter 12, verse 27, going through to the whole of chapter 13.
And in the church, God has appointed first of all apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then workers of miracles, also those having gifts of healing, those able to help others, those with gifts of administration, and those speaking in different kinds of tongues. Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Do all work miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? But eagerly desire the greater gifts. And now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.
Tempted me. I found that I'd been volunteered to contribute something to this weekend, and Jean said, "Oh, why don't you do your thing on contemplatives?" I said, "Oh, all right." But as the weekend approached, I thought, "Gosh, why did I say I would do this? It's going to be completely incongruous and inappropriate." Yet, funnily enough, as this weekend's developed, it somehow seems to be perhaps slotting into place a little, because we've heard quite a lot from Leon yesterday and Duncan on this question of cultures, how we relate to cultures, what we can learn from them. And the other thing was that last night in his exhortation, Mike was saying he wishes there was a bit more kindness about in the brotherhood. So having said that, I thought, well, maybe it's perhaps not quite so incongruous at all. But as Jean has already stirred things up a little bit, I'm going to continue by being perhaps a bit controversial. When I was working in industry, gosh, that seemed a long time ago. I sometimes had occasion to visit manufacturing facilities concerned with activities and processes which were quite different from those with which I was familiar. And I always found this particularly interesting and instructive because it often made me see my own industry and my own area of knowledge in a quite different light, sometimes giving rise to stimulating new ideas. And oddly enough, this was even more marked if the process was a bit like the one I was working in myself. And I remember once visiting British Gypsum down the road at Kirby Thor, where Dave Granger lives, to look at a particular machine and also to see how plasterboard was made. And the process was just sufficiently like my own discipline of papermaking for me to extract some important new insights, which later proved very valuable. As a community, we have, perhaps, been rather arrogant in assuming that we can learn nothing positive from other churches, least of all Catholics. Nearly everything that other churches do is considered wrong, though it has to be said that a great deal of our practices, terminology and outlook stem from churches which we are pleased to believe apostate. In fact, perhaps not generally appreciated. And maybe this has resulted in a certain spiritual impoverishment which might have been avoided. The baby has been thrown out with the bathwater. The trick, of course, is to extricate the baby without overbalancing and drowning in the bathwater. So, taking a deep breath and hoping I'm not going to be misunderstood, what I'd like to do is to draw your attention to those communities of men or women who describe themselves as contemplatives and who live in monasteries or convents. Seeing how they run their communities might possibly give us some insights as to how we might more successfully run ours and possibly help us to avoid some of the shameful situations which disfigure the face of Christadelphia and bring the name of Christ into disrepute. Now, this is an area where I can claim some first-hand knowledge. Jean said there can't be many Christadelphians who've been bought an ice cream by an Orthodox Belgian Orthodox priest, and maybe there aren't all that many Christadelphians who spent three nights in a monastic cell, which I am. So I have some first-hand knowledge of this because I stayed for a while in a Catholic monastery in connection with professional activities, and as some of you may know, my sister has been a Benedictine nun for the last 50 years or more. So for this reason I'm going to be talking mostly about what goes on in what are today called convents, though the principles are identical in communities of monks. Well, those who've visited an enclosed convent or monastery, in this country at any rate, cannot, I think, fail to have been impressed with the atmosphere of peace, joy, and, one has to say it, holiness, which seems to pervade the whole establishment from the moment the doorkeeper lets you in. Now, this is in spite of the fact that what you have here is a single-sex collection of individuals, mostly with highly charged religious feelings, living arduous and physically uncomfortable lives in close proximity with little or no opportunity for privacy. It sounds like a recipe for disaster, doesn't it? So how do they do it? Well, this question seems to me to be sufficiently intriguing to be worth looking into. You never know, we might be able to learn a thing or two. The practices and principles by which these people live, I would divide into, for the sake of this talk, into three categories. The first category consists of things which I think we would all agree are totally off the wall. And I'm not going to refer to these. I'm not in the business of setting up Aunt Sally's in order to knock them down. The second category consists of those concepts and practices which are different to the way we do things, but which are nevertheless interesting, and it could be useful to define why we disagree with them, if we do. And the third category consists of those things which we might just possibly do well to adapt to our own situation. So what makes people renounce the world and enter a religious house? Very rarely, in spite of popular fancy, is it as a result of an unhappy love affair or other worldly failure. Those few who do enter for such reasons rarely stay. There are some who enter because they are naturally devout. They lack a well-ordered existence with a preordained religious routine, and they lack saying their prayers, as distinct perhaps from actually praying. But the majority choose to enter because they think that they have been chosen by God to do so, perceived often as a result of some religious experience. They have a burning hunger and thirst for God, and they will gladly trample the world underfoot to get him. And life in monastic houses is organized precisely to enable people to attain this end. You can't be wrapped up in God unless you are totally unwrapped up in what the world has to offer. Hence, lives are turned outside in. And the rigorous discipline of monastic life is designed to achieve this by discouraging natural inclinations and desires at every turn. And to bring this into effect, the concept of separation, exterior separation that is very important. Intercourse with the outside world is kept to a minimum. The abbot or abbess may censor or suppress letters and visits if thought appropriate to do so. Now this may seem very repressive, perhaps it is, but it is all done for the ultimate good of the individual and the community as they see it. But in spite of the emphasis on separation from the world, Benedictines, at least in my experience, seem to be remarkably well informed and penetrating about what's going on in the world, both in terms of world politics and the latest modern technology. My sister, for example, who is 80-something, has in recent years become something of an expert in computer graphics. And her letters to me just lose me when she starts on this topic. Equally important to exterior separation is the concept of interior separation. Someone once said, God is everywhere, but not everywhere to us. It's only possible to get into contact with God at the very centre of one's personality. And the pursuit of interior separation is, to some extent, attained, at least initially, by a certain sense of ceremony, almost, in the way one does quite ordinary things. You never hurry, and you don't march around swinging your arms. You keep your hands clasped at waist level, eyes cast down. If you happen to meet another member or a visitor, you greet them with a Deo gratias, thanks be to God. When you enter or leave a room, you do so soundlessly. And this can be rather disconcerting at times, in my experience that monks and nuns have a habit of suddenly just appearing. The aim is to avoid anything which draws attention to oneself, even in details. For instance, if a nun is sewing, she will always make a point of putting the scissors down on the table quietly, without making a clatter, which might distract others. The state of mind known, rather misleadingly perhaps, as recollection is actively practiced. And this involves consciously emptying the mind of all thoughts and images so that the faculties are kept free from the memory, thought and desire of everything but God. Sounds easy? Have you ever tried it? It isn't easy. And it involves a lot of mental suffering. A religious, and I'm using the word here as a noun, meaning one who has embraced the religious life, a religious knows that suffering cannot be avoided until a mystical death has taken place in the earthly nature, resulting in the triumph of the spiritual over the natural. In our case, of course, this mystical death is supposed to take place at our baptism. I wonder to what extent it really does. The process of entering a religious house and becoming a member of a contemplative order is quite a long drawn out affair, not at all the snap, irrevocable step which many imagine it to be. Incidentally, the term contemplative, which is given to the way of life of these orders, is, I think, rather misleading. Far from the image of sitting in a comfortable chair, gazing into the middle distance, members of these orders live very active and hard-working lives, and religious houses will always aim to be self-supporting in as many respects as possible. A person enters in the first place as what is called a postulant, and they'll follow the rule, which I'll come to in a moment, in a somewhat mitigated form. And this usually lasts from 6 to 18 months, during which period they are free to leave, or to be asked to leave, at any time. And during this period they will have no contact with the other members, except the novice master, or mistress, whose function is to be guide, confidant, and friend to new entrants. Assuming this period is negotiated successfully, the postulant becomes a novice and is given a habit or uniform similar to but not identical with that of the full members. This stage lasts a year and a day. During this time, they will be watched and tested rigorously to see what they're made of. Some of the testing will be very severe. For example, they may be deliberately charged with misdemeanors which are known to be non-existent, in order to see how far they can emulate Christ's humility when he was falsely accused. How will we get on with that? At the end of this period, they will either leave or make their triennial vows of poverty, chastity, obedience, and enclosure, giving them the status of novice. There will now be a certain amount of communication with other members. And after the 3 years is up, they will either leave or take their perpetual vows and become full members, known as choir nuns or monks. These vows can only be dissolved by a special dispensation from Rome, and it very rarely happens. I only personally know of one case. Someone who after 18 years came to the conclusion that it had all been a terrible mistake, and after a further 10 years soul searching left. The practical everyday basis on which monasteries or convents are run is known as the rule. And this rule, formulated by Benedict of Nursia, who lived from 480 to 543 AD, was devised for his own monastery. It would take too long to go into it in detail, but as a code for community living, it displays a lot of insight and unusual common sense. Very briefly, it emphasizes praise to God, prayer, hospitality to travelers, charity to the poor, and no grumbling. Benedict was particularly hot on this one. All orders have now adopted his rule, though they apply it with different degrees of rigour. Cistercians observe the rule very strictly, while the Carthusians, which includes Trappists, are very severe indeed. Carmelites are somewhat more liberal. Time is spent mostly in prayer, manual work, which in the case of Benedictines includes a lot of literary tasks, such as translation, transcribing, bookbinding, and the like, and the recitation of the divine office. 5 or 6 hours of the day are spent in official praise to God. And besides the 8 so-called hours of Matins, Lords, Prime, First, Sext, Nones, Vespers, and Compline, there are various other devotions from time to time. On top of that, each religious will normally spend 3 or 4 hours a day in private prayer. And as you might expect, regular fasting is an important part of monastic life. To the next item in the routine. It is part of the rule that when the bell rings, you stop whatever you are doing immediately and go to the next thing. No, wait while I just finish this. The rule is looked upon as the will of God for the religious, and it invariably steps in when there is a chance of escaping down one of those lush green lanes of individual choice so dear to human nature. The actual political structure of a convent or monastery works like this. Every 3 years, the whole community elects by ballot a superior who has the responsibility for the entire house. Ideally, they should be more of a mother or father than a mistress or master. They are held in great respect because they are deemed to represent Christ. They are expected to be models of perfection. If after 3 years they are not re-elected, they of course resume their place as an ordinary member. There is also an elected council of 16 or 17 members who are consulted by the superior when important decisions have to be made. For instance, whether a novice should be allowed to take their triennial vows. Selected from these members is a much smaller body which assists the superior in the day-to-day administration of the monastery or convent. On Maundy Thursday, that is the Thursday before Easter, the superior personally serves all the community in the refectory and also washes the feet of the 12 oldest members. The entire work of day-to-day running of the monastery or convent is divided among the heads of the various departments, each office having a definite name. The most important of these offices are elected triennially. The rest are nominated once a year by the superior. Jobs are rotated and are often given to people with no obvious talent or aptitude for a particular job. I find this hard to fathom. It sounds crazy, and yet it seems to work. The line is taken that, provided the incumbent prays sufficiently to God and does all that lies in them to make the thing a success, they are certain not to fail, in the spirit of, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. As an example, the music is in charge of an organist and choirmaster or mistress. And the percentage of monks or nuns who are naturally musical is unlikely to be higher than anywhere else. But it might be a little higher among Benedictines, who in my experience are on the whole rather more intelligent and better educated than the average population. Nevertheless, certain religious houses have produced highly acclaimed recordings of plain song. Not the easiest of music to perform, even if you are singing it every day. How can they do it? By means of the choirmaster's dedication to excellence in the name of Christ, through unlimited love and patience, and by the community doing the same through unlimited love and humility. Contemplatives believe that they are never justified in saying that anything at all can't be done. they will say, if you put everything you've got into it and trust God, he will do the thing for you. Remember Peter walking on the sea. Well, this of course involves an order of faith which can't be said to be common anywhere. A particularly important office is that of infirmarian, who cares for those members of the community who fall sick. If the detailed instructions laid down in the rule and constitution are followed, then the infirmarian cannot fail to make the infirmary, perhaps surprisingly, a place of happiness and peace. The overriding principle is Matthew 25 verse 40. I was sick and you visited me. What you did to them, you did to me. In other words, the sick are looked upon, quite simply, as Christ himself. And the rest follows automatically. One of the minor but vital jobs is that of waking everybody else up in the morning. And remember that Matins, the first of the so-called hours of the divine office, commences well before dawn. This particular period of prayer and praise is deliberately chosen to coincide with that time, in the Western Hemisphere at least, when the world in general is least likely to have God in its thoughts, and to be far more likely to be occupied with pleasure, sin, or sleep. Contemplatives believe that a very major reason for their existence is to pray intensively on behalf of others who do not pray at all. They also set great store on that rather peculiar saying of Paul, I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church. And this verse is behind a lot of their thinking that by their prayers and their mental and bodily afflictions, often self-imposed, they are somehow helping to complete something which Christ left not quite finished. This doesn't seem right. Though I must say, I've never understood what this verse is about. In a similar way, perhaps, the virtue of humility is quite rightly very highly valued, so that they will regard the experience of being humiliated a cause for rejoicing. I've even heard of some spending their time actively looking for opportunities to be humiliated. Is this taking things too far? I don't know. But I've had my fair share of humiliation, and I've found that it doesn't necessarily make me humble. On certain festivals, postulants are sent to some of the more venerable members of the community, requesting that they, the postulant, should be told his or her faults. I once heard of one of these occasions when the old nun concerned said to the young postulant, I think it would be a much better idea if you were to tell me mine. And that was a practical example of humility which perhaps carried far more weight with the little one than any amount of pious homilies. Humility is considered so important because it has always been a characteristic virtue not only of Christians but of Christ. The deeper the soul is hollowed out by the self-slaying practice of humility, the greater the capacity for receiving the graces and gifts of God. There is, of course, a danger. As C.S. Lewis once wrote, it's quite possible to be proud of being humble. But most religious, in my experience, are canny enough to see that one coming and can fend it off by means of their self-knowledge and their pervading sense of humour. Contemplatives are taught from the outset the immense value, as they see it, of mortification, the painful, monotonous job of putting to death one's natural inclinations, so that the supernatural life of grace might take complete possession of one's spirit, one's being. Part of this concept is what one might call their formula for living. Not what I can allow myself, but is there anything that I can possibly manage to do without? then your needs become simple, eventually diminishing almost to vanishing point. Part of the deliberate downgrading of material needs is the idea that while the body is being fed, meal times in the refectory, it is fitting that the mind should be occupied with spiritual things. Consequently, someone is appointed to read aloud during meals. It could be from the Bible, or perhaps from the biography of some eminent religious, or maybe a devotional book of some kind. Also consequent upon the general philosophy is the fairly elaborate ceremonial, which is a feature of meal times. Those who receive, as well as those who offer, the dishes must incline, those who receive, as well as those who offer the dishes, must incline to one another with the utmost respect. Here, as in everything else, the great principle is, as Hilaire Belloc once put it, the grace of God is in courtesy. And I thought of that last night listening to Mike's exhortation. And it follows that if the person on your left takes more than their fair share of the chaves, or the person on your right spills the soup and makes slurping noises, you must contain yourself. Silence is absolute. If you want more water or bread or salt, you must ask for it only by the official gestures. And penances are enjoined for those who make a noise or spill things, that these are self-imposed by the culprit. Some orders of monks and nuns, though still enclosed, are teaching orders. Hence the celebrated, or infamous, according to your point of view, convent schools. Suffice it to say that the work of education isn't considered incompatible with a contemplative life, and a religious is not only expected to teach well, but also to aim at such particularly close union with God that Christ lives in her. Thus, and only thus, could she transmit him to the children. Perhaps this work involves even more particularly those acts of self-conquest which are considered so important in the contemplative life. Occupants of a religious house consist, with very few exceptions, of people who are more concerned that others should have the first places rather than themselves. Postulants are taught from the outset that community life would be impossible unless the interactions of life were safeguarded by some definite code. Hence, the courtesy towards one another, which forms so important a feature of religious life. A deep spirit of reverence towards what they see as the God-indwelled souls around them is instilled in the noviceship as a preventative against rudeness, selfishness, or even familiarity. As far as nuns are concerned, contrary to general opinion, the majority do not become fussy, spinsterish, and ultra-feminine. At least if they do, it's their own fault. Nuns regard the state of becoming, as they call it, a spiritual spinster, as the worst disaster that can befall them. The sense of nearness of God, invariably to be expected when religious life is lived fully and generously, induces a width of outlook, a depth of character, a conspicuous sense of fun, and an enrichment of the entire personality, possibly not attainable by any other means. And this really is true. I've seen it happen. Nevertheless, whatever the romantic novels say, the act of entering a monastery or convent does not automatically produce instant holiness. It may well take a lifetime to get anywhere near the very high standards which are expected. And, unfortunately, even in the best regulated religious houses, just occasionally, one will come across a person who will stop at nothing to get their own way. Ideally, such individuals should have been weeded out at the novice stage, but there may be times when the system of safeguards breaks down somewhere. and such people can become a positive and serious menace to the community. And if the solution persists, it becomes a matter of action by the superior, who has two options. One way is to enforce conformity to the accepted standard of community life under the aegis of holy obedience, warning that a refusal to comply will result in expulsion from the community. The other way is known as the supernatural way. The superior may decide that it is the community which must shoulder the cross which divine providence has laid upon it, and simply see the difficult member as affording an opportunity to practice self-denial, and thus progressing with thankfulness rather than resentment in holiness. Which of these two courses to follow must sometimes involve the superior in some very difficult decisions. One point which is watched carefully is that of particular friendships developing between two or three individuals. It's easy to see why. If two people become particularly close, they will inevitably begin to talk about the others, and you know what follows from that. So such friendships are firmly discouraged. A bond of love will exist between each and every member impartially, and closer relationships should be unnecessary. Perhaps as an extension of this philosophy, the New Testament concept of having all things in common is embraced comprehensively. There is no such thing as mine or thine. An individual religious will even speak of our knife and fork. Religious life, as contemplative steered, is essentially a life of sacrifice. It will never succeed if based on selfishness. And you can never begin to overcome selfishness unless you first overcome self-deception. It is vital to know oneself. As Jung said, one's shadow as well as one's light. It will be obvious that, to a religious contemplative, prayer holds an extremely important place in their lives. And they believe that success in prayer depends very largely on how you behave in between times of prayer. If you allow yourself to become disturbed or agitated, you will find a barrier has arisen when you return to prayer. So you have to cultivate interior tranquility, never allowing the memory or imagination to become cumbered or dissipated. And this involves cold, calculating acts of will. And no matter how bitter one's own personal suffering, the life of the community has to go on. The right way to deal with suffering, they believe, is to raise up your will and hold the pain at bay, refusing it entrance to the citadel of your soul. Easier said than done. But if it can be achieved, suffering will become your servant instead of your master. The trick is to learn to accept everything, no matter whether it hurts or pleases you, as God's particular choice for you. As a Russian religious once said in the face of terrible trials he was bearing, "Glory be to God for everything, absolutely everything." You have to force yourself to pray, "I want this thing because it is your will. I would not have it otherwise." So monks and nuns should, and in practice do, look serene, as they are not only holy but happy as well. Well, I've tried to give you a brief outline of the thinking and practices obtaining in the community of contemplatives, and I've done so with very little comment. As I said at the outset, I hope I'm not going to be misunderstood. I'm not actually recommending that we should put a stoup of holy water in the vestibule of any Christadelphia meeting room. I'm not actually recommending anything. But I've had to explain something of the doctrinal framework in which contemplatives order their lives. Certainly, there does seem to be rather a whiff of salvation by works about it all, and perhaps the fixation on unity with God himself rather than with God's eternal purposes is rather two-dimensional. I do wonder too if there is a point where self-abasement could become self-destruction, though I must say I haven't ever seen any evidence of it. And I think the ancient danger could be there of pursuing asceticism for asceticism's sake. It would, of course, be very easy to demolish their doctrinal framework as hopelessly unscriptural, and therefore their way of life must be immoral. This has been the standard Christadelphian position. But I think it perhaps misses the point. I believe that if we take a cool, dispassionate look at these people, there is much food for thought. There might even be something for us to learn. If there's one quality which I would pick out as being paramount in their lives, I think I would call it their sheer religious professionalism. Within the framework of what they consider to be Christianity, they are seasoned, full-time professionals, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Now, I'm very much aware that there are Christians in this room who do fit that description absolutely. But for most of the rest of us, people like me, the way we have chosen to order our lives makes it difficult to achieve this ideal. We have to earn our living in a competitive, unforgiving world. So we have one foot in the world and one in the spirit. No wonder we sometimes seem to be doing the splits. Another thing which impresses me is their dedication to prayer. Each religious will normally spend 3 to 4 hours a day in private prayer, on top of community devotions. Sometimes I get the feeling we're only playing at things. Finally, and this is what perhaps impresses me most, there's this care and respect for each other. This must come about very largely from their continual concern with attaining an ideal of personal humility. A 6th century contemplative, one Diodocus of Photike, said that humility was forgetting successes immediately. No doubt this is part of the story, though not everything. Since we're on the subject, perhaps I could conclude by sharing with you some thoughts on humility in prayer by a 19th century mystic, one Theophan the Recluse. He doesn't belong to the Catholic tradition, but I should think his views would be shared by the majority of the contemplatives we've been contemplating. Here are just a few of his maxims. Humbling oneself is not yet humility, but only the desire and search for humility. If a man is humble, he never thinks that he has been treated worse than he deserves. He stands so low in his own estimation that no one, however hard they try, can think more poorly of him than he thinks of himself. Humility is acquired by obedience and surrender of our own will. Judge yourself, and you will stop judging others. In prayer, the mind must descend into the heart, not the other way around. Anticipate trouble at every moment, and when it comes, encounter it as something expected. We must not allow joy to lead to negligence. It is impossible to live at peace with God without continual repentance. Complete serenity of mind is a gift of God. But this serenity is not given without our own intense effort. You will achieve nothing by your own efforts alone. Yet God will not give you anything unless you work with all your strength. And finally, unless you exercise your power of thought, the soul becomes numb.